You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Fairhead. Coming up, we'll learn about an effort by Green Bay Area Public Schools to get meals out to students and children beyond the schools themselves. Now, Wisconsin remains under a statewide mask mandate after Governor Evers issued a new emergency order on Thursday. That came about an hour after the Republican-led legislature had voted to kill the previous mandate. The GOP says the orders are illegal, that a governor can issue only one 60-day emergency order, which he did back in March. Evers doesn't see it that way. In a video announcing the new mask mandate, he accused Republicans of putting politics ahead of public safety.
Our fight against this virus isn't over. It's not going away, especially as we see mutations of this virus in our state and others. Wearing a mask is the most basic thing we can do to keep each other safe. If the legislature keeps playing politics and we don't keep wearing masks, we're going to see more preventable deaths, and it's going to take even longer to get our state and our economy back on track.
Republicans are working on a new resolution to block the latest order and are considering filing an emergency action in the state Supreme Court. That court heard arguments in a challenge to the order last fall, but has not said when it would make a decision. You can let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about a statewide mask mandate? Do we need one, or should that decision be left to local governments or businesses? How concerned are you about the legality of emergency orders? Even if you want an emergency order, do you think the governor has exceeded his authority? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Charlie, good to have you back with us.
Nice to be here, Rob.
Well, there's a New York Times headline. I don't have it in front of me, but it was something like Wisconsin had a mask mandate and then lost it and has it back again for now. I mean, it's back and forth on this thing. What do you make of all this?
It's like a tennis match, isn't it? I think it's emblematic of the politics of the age, whether it's at the national level or what you see in a lot of states, which is the parties sort of digging in on a perception that their position is the right one. And there seems to be a general unwillingness to sit down in an amicable way and try to compromise on these issues. I think even some of the rhetoric that we saw in the few days surrounding the joint resolution that repealed the mask mandate, there seemed to be very little common ground that either side was finding with each other, even scoffing at the idea that they'd engage in the administrative rule process to try to create some sort of mask mandate to get us through the process of inoculation when the, as we try to vaccinate everyone for the pandemic. So it seems sort of in form with what we've been seeing for the last several years. But one would have thought that sort of as we're ending this cycle with the pandemic, that cooler heads might have prevailed so that we can get over the last couple of hurdles before we finish out this process.
Republican State Senator and Senate President Chris Kapinga was on WPR's The Morning Show today. He said, this isn't about the mask mandate itself, but an abuse of power by Governor Evers in reissuing the order past the initial authority. Here's a listen.
It's COVID now. But what happens when it's another issue? And I talk to my friends who are Democrats on this and remind them that what if this is a Republican governor and they choose to act unilaterally after a 60-day emergency order and start putting things into place that you don't think are appropriate? That divided government, split government is there to protect everyone from unilateral power and authority. That's not how Republicans or the Republic works.
So, Charlie, the argument that it isn't about the mandate in and of itself, it's about a governor exceeding the authority granted to him by current Wisconsin law. What do you think?
It's a fair point, and it's the point that was made before the state Supreme Court on November 16th when the litigation that was brought forward regarding the mandate was argued. And so I think the Republicans have some firm ground to stand on here. It can be abused. This particular section of state code allows for the governor one 60-day emergency order. But of course, you can extend the hypothetical from your clip. What happens if an emergency does have to be extended? Under what circumstances? If an order ends Does that mean that we're basically back at go on the monopoly board and we get to start all over again? When does an emergency begin and end? When does an order end and you can begin another one? The statute as drawn is rather vague. And so, well, yes, there is an interpretation of Section 323 of the code that suggests 60 days should be the point at which you pull the plug. At the same time, it is not clear about when and how the governor might be able to extend it, even if the legislature objects. And of course, it really begs the question, at what point should the legislature engage? So, you know, the quote there is about, do you want the governor to abuse the power? The flip side of that same coin is, can the legislature abuse its authority by not engaging the governor in a conversation about what type of declaration is appropriate and how long they should run? It's a two-way street. It's a two-sided coin, and they both have to engage in this kind of argument.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College in De Pere about the back and forth on Wisconsin's mask mandate. You can join in with your thoughts. What do you want to see happen? Mask mandate or no? Do you think the governor has abused his authority here, or is he doing the right thing? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us, Jerry?
Well, I'd like to just make a couple points. Although there may not be a whole lot of supporting evidence, my feeling on the mask mandate is healthcare facilities, nursing homes, exposing the elderly to the younger crowd. Absolutely. Masks should be worn because we don't want to kill any more old people than Governor Cuomo did in New York. As for any other facilities, leave it up to the businesses. If they want a mandate that you have to wear one to enter their place of business, if they want your money and you want to wear a mask, that's wonderful. Beyond that, it's a violation of personal freedoms and rights.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Charlie, some Republicans have offered a plan, not exactly that, but specifying more narrowly which facilities could be covered on a mask mandate. I don't know if that's gone anywhere. But as Jerry wanted, leaving businesses, for example, on their own to decide something like that.
And certainly that kind of stepwise approach is one that is a feasible alternative to the mask mandate that the governor has been employing over the last more than half year at this point. And certainly that's the process by which you want to engage this discussion between the governor and the legislature. I think the other side would come back and make the counter argument that one of the difficulties with that is individuals won't know what they're required to do in what kind of circumstance. Certainly, too, we could leave this to localities. But as you do your day-to-day business, it might be difficult to know whether or not a mask is mandated in one place and not in another. And if you find yourself in a condition where you might be more susceptible to catching it, sort of randomly walking into places that may or may not have a mask mandate makes it a little bit more difficult. So the argument from Evers is the blanket mask mandate makes more sense because everyone is covered in a uniform way. And of course, Jerry's making an argument for personal freedom, which is one that conservatives and Republicans often make. And I think the alternative he's offering and one that the legislature is offering as well is a starting point for the discussion with the governor.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Tim in Richland Center. Tim, hi.
Hi. I have several hundred employees and own several businesses. And I just want to say Republicans are bad for business. I want to get back up to full employment. And the sooner everybody masks up and the sooner this virus goes away, the more we can do business. And they're just prolonging it. And it's just one example of how they're bad for business. That's my new mantra. Republicans are bad for business.
Tim, thanks for the call. Thanks for sharing your experience. Charlie, we saw a lot of groups, medical groups, health groups, but also some business groups, I think, line up and say, no, please keep the mask mandate, making similar arguments to our caller.
I mean, according to epidemiologists, and I'm a political scientist, so sometimes I'm not considered a real one, but if we lean on the real scientists out there, you know, they're suggesting that, as Tim is, if we get uniform mask wearing, we're going to reduce transmissibility, we're going to reduce infection rates, we're going to reduce death rate, and hopefully that will help us get to the point of vaccinations and help us all get back to normal. And, you know, the lack of masks may exacerbate that. You know, sometimes, and I use this metaphor with my students in class a lot, You know, sometimes we hit the plus button on the Google Maps and boy, we get the street view, but sometimes it takes hitting the minus button to sort of get a broader perspective of what we're trying to accomplish here. And I think that's what the point he's trying to make here is that sometimes you have to give up some of that individual freedom to achieve some longer, long-term goals. And I think some of that debate about the 60 days is about that. Is an extension prudent in this sort of circumstance? Because that's what we need to get us to the long-term goal. But again, that's a political dispute and one that the parties are going to have to wrangle with if they're going to come to some conclusion about this issue.
Thanks for the call. Go to Teresa next in Reedsburg. Teresa, hi.
Hi. What
did you want to tell us about, Teresa?
Well, I'm a nurse in a ER, and I just wanted to say for people who think that the science is sketchy behind masks, it most certainly is not, and we've been masking forever in facilities during this type of a season. And I think mask wearing has cut down overall on all illnesses this year because we haven't seen even the typical influenza, strep, respiratory viruses. And I think if we don't keep it consistent as a statewide rule, people won't be comfortable with it. They won't know where to wear it and where not to wear it. So I think it's important that we keep it up till people are vaccinated and the numbers are way down. And also, I listened to that congressperson this morning, and he just sounded upset that no one talked to them. It didn't sound like he had like an argument that masks were good or bad. He just said he didn't talk to us. Well, they didn't talk to him either, and they really don't usually. So if you have that kind of relationship where you know you can't get anything passed, why would you?
Teresa, thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, getting back to kind of where you started, not a working relationship between a Republican legislature and a Democratic governor here in Wisconsin.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's, you know, we see that when the legislature doesn't pass a COVID-related bill for about 10 months, as we're in the midst of this, I think it exposes some of the difficulties that we're having in the partisan politics and the environment that we're dealing with partisan politics today. And I think that's what, you know, Teresa is trying to make a point here. Somebody sometimes has to be magnanimous and come to the table and try to get this done. And, you know, to the credit of both the governor and the Republican held Senate, they tried to negotiate some elements, but that seemed to be overturned by some of the actions by the assembly. And so it seems like, you know, the state legislature itself can't come to a compromise about how they're going to work with the government in divided government. And that's really the key. It's how do you give a little to get a little? How do you swallow some pride to make sure that you get some or most of what you want and give up a little bit more? And I think it's going to take something on an issue of this kind of importance to try to break a logjam. And if they do, it might accrue real benefits to the work that's going to have to get done in the next year.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the back and forth over Wisconsin's statewide mask mandate and Governor Evers' emergency powers. Charlie Jacobs is with us, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Should Wisconsin have a statewide mask mandate? Should it be coming from the governor extending his order or the legislature if you do want a mandate? Do you want to see a Democratic governor and Republican lawmakers work together to agree on something? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about Governor Evers' emergency powers and the statewide mask mandate. Last week, the Republican legislature voted to strike down the order, saying Evers only had the authority to issue the original 60-day order last March. He answered by issuing a new mandate. And then there's the state Supreme Court. What are they going to do? Charlie Jacobs is our guest, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Charlie, before we go back to our callers, we've got three branches of government. We've been talking about a divide between two of them, the governor and the legislature. What are you watching for in the courts?
Yeah, it's funny to me how long it's taken them to rule in this case. And the reason I say that is because some of the earlier cases regarding COVID rules and regulations, you know, in particular, the stay-at-home order that was overturned on May 13th, the issue was resolved relatively quickly. This one, they've kind of sat on it. I'm wondering whether or not they were hopeful that they wouldn't really have to touch it and they would let the legislature get back in place. It would be negotiated and it would basically be a moot point. Wouldn't have to deal with this one anymore. And it seems like it's just swung right back into their chambers and ready for them to resolve. So it may be that they've already discussed it. It may be that they find it to be a hot potato and they don't really want to try to grapple with this because they may be responsible for aiding and abetting the ending of a mask order or aiding and abetting the trampling of the rule of law, at least in the perspective of Republicans in the state house. So I think this is a tricky one for them. And they also have a new balance of power with Justice Hagedorn often siding with the liberal members of the court. So they may be just sort of wrangling over language and trying to figure out exactly what they want to do.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Personally, I do believe this is an overstep of the governor's authority. But that being said, we've been in this emergency for over a year. And irregardless of what the governor may, or any emergency that the governor calls, people understand that there's an emergency and they're going to wear a mask regardless of what the governor says or doesn't say. And personally, I'm getting kind of tired of the debate at the state level, and I find it offensive. Stop treating me like a little kid. And secondly, of all the things the state legislature could debate at this point in the argument, this is the last one they should be looking at. They should be looking at, why do the websites not work? I got an email to register for an appointment for an inoculation. They told me the website to go to, and it didn't work. And there's a lot of frustration going on here amongst myself or with myself and among others as well. And I see this with a lot of the colleagues that I work with and family members who live in other states. So,
Mark. I want to jump in. We want to get to a couple more callers in. But Charlie, Mark thinking, hey, lawmakers and the governor have better things to do with their time, he says.
Well, you know, one of the points Mark makes is sort of interesting that the governor seems to keep saying that, well, we need a mask mandate, but don't worry because we're not really going to enforce it because nobody yet has been fined because of it. And so, you know, there's sort of a disconnect in the message that's being sent. And I suppose there are those individuals who find this very, very paternalistic. I think the argument is the consistency that we'll see across the state when various institutions, whether governmental or non-governmental, are required to do it, you're going to see more compliance, in part because it becomes part of your day-to-day life and you know you're supposed to do it at certain times and places. And so that may be the motivation behind it.
Thanks for the call. We'll go to Kathy now in Crandon. Kathy, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that it's very difficult up here in the Northwoods. We get so many vacationers, snowmobilers, fishermen, tourists up in the area, and it has become a free-for-all since this all started. None of them seem to feel that they need to wear a mask, even though a lot of us are out there working in the public and have our masks on. But it seems that when they get here, they can crowd up, they can just do what they want, no masks. So I know that the mandate's not being enforced, but the representative this morning said, I'm sure everyone will do the right thing. Well, they're not. They come on vacation and no masks. And it's really difficult for those of us that are out working.
Kathy, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, in the handling of the pandemic, one critique I've seen of the U.S. across the board in some ways is lack of consistent messaging. And I think that's what our caller is pointing to maybe the outcome of.
And it is difficult. And part of it is because we have a system of federalism. And at least for 115 years or so, in the case of pandemics, the United States Supreme Court has been very deferential to the states and said this is not a power to be exercised by the national government. 10th Amendment and the Reserve Power Clause takes these police powers, these health, welfare, and safety kinds of laws, and defers to state action. And so even though you might get a message from the national government, you don't get national impact because of the various ways in which it's going to be enforced in the individual states. And so that mixed message and the muddled message and the contradictory message creates this kinds of division because you have so many competing ideas about what is most appropriate and most effective for orders like mask mandates.
Time for one more caller. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, guys. So I understand both sides. And one of the things I'm kind of worried about is you never see when the Democrats and Republicans are arguing about this, they never come up with any sort of even the idea of a compromise. It's just, I am right, you are wrong. And it's just, to me, it's just, is politics corrupted us to the point where that's all it is I'm right, you're wrong, and nothing else matters?
Michael, thanks a lot for the call, Charlie.
Michael raises some interesting points, and we could spend a couple of hours on the radio talking about some of the deep-seated institutional issues that have led to this, including issues of redistricting and gerrymandering, hyperpartisanship, the loss of moderates in legislatures. It creates a rancor and an acrimony that makes compromise very, very difficult, where you can't even start a conversation because both sides are at the extreme poles and nowhere near the median. And it's I wouldn't say corrupting the politics, but it is eroding the kind of trust that's necessary to accomplish good ends for the public. And when 70% of the public in the last Marquette poll in August said that they want a mask mandate and we can't get a compromise, it seems a little unnerving.
Thanks for everyone's calls. And Charlie, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We talked to him today about the ongoing back and forth over Wisconsin's statewide mask mandate and the emergency powers of the governor. Coming up, there are Meals on Wheels for students and other children in the Green Bay area. We'll learn about new concession trailers hitting the road to help get food assistance delivered during the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at the state's negotiations over a new contract with Foxconn. Now, feeding public school children in the Green Bay area was already a big job, but during the pandemic, with students at home for virtual learning, getting meals to kids got a lot more difficult. Green Bay area public schools have been providing meals for pickup for children in the area, and starting in the fall last year, they added concession trailers, able to serve as mobile meal sites. Lynette Kino is the food service director for Green Bay Area Public Schools. Lynette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, first, Lynette, in normal times, forget the pandemic for a sec, how big a challenge is it to feed all these kids in the school district?
Right. We have over 21,000 children, 21,000 children in our district, and with all of our schools, it can be challenging, but it's also very rewarding with the staff that we have out there and the great opportunities that we have for each meal service we provide.
Now, talk about the transition when the district switched to virtual learning. What did that mean? What did you have to figure out?
Yeah, it was something different. You don't get trained for this. You don't get trained for a pandemic. So we had to really tighten our apron strings and really figure out how can we do this? How can we feed the food to our students? So what we ended up doing is really doing what we know, and with us doing summer feeding at locations at our schools, we thought, well, let's do this. And that's what we started with. We started with serving at our summer hub schools, where the schools that offered summer feeding, we started feeding at those locations. And it actually worked out really well. So we were very pleased. And then we just continued feeding that way through the summer. And then when we found out September 1 school was not going to look quite the same as it did normally when school opens up, we branched out and we fed at all of our schools. And we just had different times for serving. And we wanted to make sure that we are available for the families around the clock from, you know, from morning time to a late 5 o'clock pickup time for the families. And we've been doing that. And we actually just recently hit over the 2 million mark for meals that we've been feeding.
Now, that's for people coming to you and picking up food. And now in the fall, you also started another thing, food trucks, basically, mobile meal delivery sites. What led you there?
Yes, we did. And it was something, how can we get to the schools? That we were at the schools and we need to get students to our schools, but how can we get to the students that did not have transportation, that it was just really, really difficult to get there. So what we did is we discussed in some meetings and thought about getting there. And we thought, well, let's look at something that's going to be attractive and also something that we can use when we aren't feeding during this pandemic. And we thought about concession trailers, and they're great. You can go look at them on our school district website, and we have been offering those at the different locations since October, and we have served almost 30,000 meals.
And now, do your food decisions, your menu decisions, do they change when you know, it's for pickup or, you know, delivering these mobile services versus serving kids in the school cafeteria?
That's a great question. Actually, the only thing that really has changed with the way that we are serving is that when they come and pick up our meals are cold. And we give the families heating instructions, but we also have heating instructions on our school district website. So the families know how to properly heat them. So they are following food safety.
Well, now looking into the – oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Oh, no. Please, go on.
Looking into the future now, I mean, with every district, there's the open question of when, if you come back this year, if it's in a month or not till the fall, what happens? Are you ready to scramble if the kids are back in school and you have to reopen the cafeteria again?
We are ready. yes, things are going to look a little different where all of our items for our grab and go, things are all going to be prepackaged or wrapped. Salad bars are going to look a little bit different where items are going to be pre-made for the students and they will all be covered. And we're going to, if it's our deli station, where they can come and make a pre-made deli sandwich and with our toppings, that we will make sure that they're in containers, our staff will be putting them on, but then the sandwich is going to be wrapped for the students to go. And it's going to look the same in our pizza line. Pizzas will be in little triangle containers. At our taco lines, all of our items will be in souffle cups.
Well, I'm hungry now. Lynette, thanks for sharing with us how you've kept up with all this. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
Lynette Kino is Food Service Director for Green Bay Area Public Schools. She joined us for a look at mobile meal delivery in the school district during the pandemic and how they've reacted to a changing situation. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum looking back in the early days of Wisconsin Life with an icy story. This month marks the 10th anniversary of the program here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
10 years ago this month, Wisconsin Life became a regular weekly segment on WPR. To kick things off, producers created Ice Week, which explored the many ways ice defines life in Wisconsin. Living here, we know that the lakes are worlds unto themselves. But when one becomes covered with a roof of ice nearly 2 feet thick, it takes on an isolation and beauty that few are brave enough to ever see firsthand. Aubrey Ralph followed a group of divers who were bold enough to take the plunge.
I'm out on the ice off Picnic Point on Lake Mendota, on my way to meet up with a group of divers. I can see what looks like a little Arctic camp with a red and white dive flag and warming shelters and piles of ice blocks. I can't help but feel I've wandered into a National Geographic special. The first order of business this morning is cutting a dive hole, which is actually a triangle.
The edges are narrow enough so that a diver can put their hands on either side and then hop out. If they can't get out for some reason, they can back into the corner and then someone on the surface can grab their tank and pull them out.
Just looking at that water is enough to take your breath away. It's so cold and dark, but that's also what makes it so amazing. Instructors Tammy and Matt will be the first in today, equipped with special underwater communications gear, so they could give me an audio tour.
Can you hear me?
Roger, I got really good sound, no static or anything up here.
This feels awesome! Yeah, we got about 35.
35 degrees, it sounds balmy.
The main focus of today's dive is an old underwater research lab called the Habitat, a project of the University of Wisconsin that was abandoned some 20 years ago.
Hey, there it is! That's great visibility! Kind of looks like a lunar lander module from the Apollo missions. You have a long cylindrical vessel with a couple of portholes and a hatch at the bottom and a hatch at the top. What's really neat about this habitat is the numbers of fish that you see at the base of the module. We've got about 100 to 200 sunfish, crappie, a couple of bass.
There was a video camera attached to a monitor topside, so I actually got to see some of the action.
All right, there's the structure that it's sitting on. So you see, like, that's a big rusty pipe. Here you can see the cylinders.
People used to be able to go up inside and they'd spend a day there doing research.
I'm looking up and we're getting a lot of ambient light through the ice. It's really pretty.
Yeah, it sure is.
You really see how flat it is and all the bubbles working their way along the surface. You can see the triangular hole and just see everybody working around the hole. Hi there, someone's waving at us.
In all, they spent about 20 minutes under and visited a lot of neat things, and including a Model T Ford. After they got out, the class began, and there were three or four more dives. Then it was time to pack up and head home, which includes pushing the blocks back into the hole and marking it off. It's like a big triangular glass of ice water. I'm glad I got to stay warm, but the kid in me would have gone in a second. Who knows what grand adventures lie in that cold world under the ice.
WPR's Aubrey Ralph brought us that story on ice diving in Madison. And Aubrey tells us how they got the idea for the piece, which was one of the first Wisconsin Life stories ever.
The image that immediately made me want to do it was, and I don't know if it was a National Geographic, if I was in like a doctor's office, but the ice holes from underwater looking up with the diver between the camera and the ice hole, and there were fish. And I was like, holy cow, that is such a cool thing. And it was and still is the most challenging piece I've done because I made a hydrophone. So I now have the sound of like, what does a chainsaw sound like underwater when you're cutting through ice? And the sound of the divers going in. It was a lot of fun.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You can hear more Wisconsin Life stories that celebrate the program's 10-year history all month here on WPR. Coming up, we'll look at Foxconn's latest moves in Wisconsin and a possible renegotiation of the company's deal with the state. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, true crime books and podcasts have been big hits lately. Find out how they're telling stories and trying to shine light on the criminal justice system. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Foxconn is being sued for breaking its promise to build an LCD manufacturing plant in Mount Pleasant, in the process costing local governments hundreds of million dollars to prepare for it. That suit filed by a real estate developer comes as Wisconsin and Foxconn look at an updated deal to reflect what will ultimately happen at the site. But state leaders disagree still over what has and hasn't happened since Foxconn broke ground in Wisconsin in 2018. The company committed to building a facility that would make large screens and hire up to 13,000 people around the state. The state says it hasn't happened yet, and the company won't get billions of dollars in tax incentives as a result. Ricardo Torres is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Ricardo, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, bring us up to date, Ricardo. What has happened on the Foxconn site in southeastern Wisconsin?
So they are building. The most noticeable building that they have completed, at least structurally on the outside, is this very big globe. It kind of, if you've been to Epcot, it's kind of a little bit like that globe. And so you could see that from the freeway when you're driving down in there. And they're still building, and they claim, at least by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who toured the facility, told me that they are building circuit boards. According to him, it's not clear as to what those circuit boards are going to be for. We know that they've built masks during this pandemic. Governor Evers thanked them publicly for that. They have some sort of deal with a company called Medtronic to build ventilators. It's not clear if those ventilators have been built yet, how many have been built. We're still trying to get answers on that. So that's some of the summary of what's being built down there so far.
And you've been following over a period of time now a possible renegotiation of the state's deal with Foxconn. What might be in the works for a renegotiation?
So that's really hard to tell. Right now, details are have not been made public. The WEDC says that it is their policy when they're negotiating with a company that they don't reveal some of the context of those negotiations to keep those conversations private. And they say they do that with all businesses that they talk to, and including Foxconn. But one thing that we have learned, we learned this last in December when we obtained some letters between the WEDC and Foxconn, is that Foxconn is willing to take less in tax incentives and tax credits as part of this deal, whatever it may be. And so right now, it seems like both sides are pretty optimistic that a new deal will be made. As to what that deal looks like, we know that it won't require legislation to be passed, like the first batch of tax incentives to lure Foxconn here. In 2017, the state legislature passed a bill that would provide up to $2.85 billion worth of tax incentives if Foxconn met certain hiring and capital investment thresholds. And so far, since that passage, they haven't been awarded any tax credits from that bill. But when you talk to other people, when you talk to other lawmakers, they'll point to the millions spent on infrastructure upgrades for roads and for water and things like that, that have gone to support the project. So Minority Leader Gordon Hintz has said that he feels that the Foxconn's already got a pretty good deal from the state already without getting any of those $2.85 billion worth of tax credits so far.
And we've seen arguments from Republicans and Democrats over, in effect, whether Foxconn has been a good deal. Democrats saying what they're doing doesn't resemble very closely the initial deal. Republicans, you quoted in some of your pieces, saying, yeah, but they're doing something and there are some jobs. How are people evaluating success or failure here?
So the WEDC seems to be evaluating Foxconn based on the initial contract, which said that they were going to build a generation 10.5 LCD facility, and that would be capable of building large screens. But that has since been scaled back to a generation 6, capable of building screens for your cell phone, your tablet, your TV at home. And so it's a much different project. And there's also, I mentioned the globe earlier, that's being built by a subsidiary of Foxconn called the Foxconn Industrial Internet. FEI is how they like to be known. And they're not included in the original agreement. And so the state has basically said any work that they do, any hiring or building, you know, capital investments that they do doesn't count towards the project because they're not included in the initial deal. And like you mentioned, Republicans are saying they're building, they're hiring people, we should give them some sort of credit for that. And so that's where Republicans and Democrats seem to be at an impasse.
Talking to Ricardo Torres from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with an update on what's going on with Foxconn in Wisconsin and a possible deal renegotiation. And Ricardo, I mentioned a lawsuit from a real estate developer, Hintz Real Estate Development Company. I don't know if there's any relationship there to the lawmaker you mentioned earlier, Gordon Hintz. What do we know about the company and the suit?
So we don't know. I mean, we don't believe that there's any sort of relation between the person down in Racine County and Gordon Hintz. At least that hasn't been made public to us in any way. And so this is a private individual, private company that owns land in Racine County. And this lawsuit is kind of funky in the sense that it's filed on behalf of Racine County and the village of Mount Pleasant to because of these violations. But it also names the village of Mount Pleasant and Racine County as defendants. So it's not really clear as to how those two entities, the county and the village, are going to be able to be on both sides of this lawsuit. And so we're just taking a wait and see approach to see how the courts decide on this. But this isn't the first time Foxconn's been sued. They've been sued before by people who lived in the areas. And that suit was thrown out in 2018. And so it's not really clear what standing, if any, this individual has, but who knows what the court will decide.
Now, Ricardo, when this was first negotiated, I think a lot of people saw it as maybe a transformational event in Wisconsin's economy, the supply chain for construction, and then the actual production that would happen in these facilities was going to trickle out all over the state. It would spark a technology industry in Wisconsin, eighth wonder of the world, then President Trump called it. Is there still a hope that something that big is going to come out of it, or have most people scaled down their expectations now?
I think some people have scaled down their expectations now. That's not saying that they are only expecting Foxconn and Foxconn alone to be this this technological company here. I think people are still hoping for some sort of advanced manufacturing or some sort of new 21st century companies coming to the area, but it's not what it was expected back in 2017 when we were viewing this as a possible transformational deal. And Corey Mason, the mayor of Racine County, he was in the state legislature at the time. And he's a Democrat, and he has said multiple times he voted in favor of it because he viewed it as the most transformational jobs opportunity of his lifetime for that area. And who knows? It still could come out in, 10 years from now, and it could still be something in the positive. But as of right now, it's kind of hard to see what that supply chain is going to look like. So far, we haven't had very many indications as to what is, if anything, is coming. But they're still making deals and they're still trying to build stuff there. So we're just checking it out.
In just our last few moments, Ricardo, you're covering, I see in your reporting, a lot of threads related to Foxconn. What are you watching for next?
So we're watching for obviously what this new deal is going to look like. We know that it's not going to need passage from the state legislature. We're looking to see how the WEDC is going to be helping in any way, whatever way that may be, in helping Foxconn. We're obviously always staying on top of new contracts, new partnerships that Foxconn has. Bloomberg reported that Foxconn was going to be building Google servers down here. That's something that we haven't, no one's been very open about that, but it's possible. And so we're just looking for some of those little things. We're obviously looking to see what is going to happen with this lawsuit and other legal actions, whatever they may be coming down the line. So yeah, there's always something to look out for when it comes to Foxconn.
It's a rewarding beat. Ricardo, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
Ricardo Torres is a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him about a new lawsuit against Foxconn and a state renegotiation for a new contract with the company. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. It's the Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, Kate and her guests look at the latest news on the second impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate for former President Trump. That's tomorrow at 8 on the Morning Show. Up next, it's news that a top country music star was dropped from his record deal after he was filmed using a racial slur. We'll talk to two music journalists about whether they see it as a turning point for how the country industry deals with race. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.